Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back with episode 41, Paleolithic Solution, and it is a little early for us today, Rob.
It's an early morning edition, yeah, so if there's a long silence, it's not because of a goof-up in our technical side, it's because Andy and I fell asleep, so I'll be cuddled up with the gatto, and Andy will just be, like, massaging his beard or something like that, so...
Dude, leave the beard alone. It's well manicured. It's not as nice as Dallas's probably, but it's about as manicured as I can get it.
I don't know, man. I heard somebody call you ZZ Top the other
ZZ Top.
And then it ran, so.
Dude, I'm going for the Wendler look.
Everybody is, apparently.
I'll just be a much smaller version, like 1/8 the size with a big beard.
I think you'd be much taller. But so you can get the scale weight at some point.
Jeez Louise, I don't know, man. What's going on with you?
Not too much. The book is to the printer. We're planning out the book signing gig. You know, this is now time to shift into shameless self-whoring and self-promotion. So we'll be unveiling some of our plans for trying to promote the book and get it out there to as many folks as we can. But just a huge relief having that done, and then right on the heels of wrapping it up, you know, talking to the Tuttle Publishing people and Barnes & Noble people and all that, they were basically like, yeah, you're about 50% done. Now you've got to market and sell. And I'm just like, oh, mother of God. So it's an eye-opening experience. I mean, it's really, really cool, but at the same time, it's pretty stressful because this is definitely, like, taking me totally outside my comfort zone, not used to doing all of this, you know, the marketing and thinking about trying to get into media and all that. And it's definitely cool on the one hand, but it's pretty intimidating too. Like it's going to be a kind of a wild 6 or so months of really pushing this thing to make it go. But it's just so nice to have it done. Like I started writing blog posts again because I have literally like 210, 212 bookmarked subjects that I want to write some blog posts on. So I'm going to start just banging those out whenever I've got spare time and then stick them in queue to pop up in a couple of days and hopefully get 3 or 4 blog posts a day at least of like substantive content because I haven't done anything in like a year. So,
wow. The return of Rob the blogger.
Yes. Yes. And then it looks like I may be, they're kind of interviewing me with my first article, but I may be a staff writer for Fight Magazine, which is an MMA-oriented magazine, pretty big distribution. I had not really heard of it. I've seen it in Barnes & Noble a couple of times, but I just haven't followed it all that much. And so it looks like I'm going to be kind of test run for those guys, but they need somebody who's got a nutrition S&C background and the ability to answer some technical questions. And I theoretically, apparently there was nobody else looking for it because they contacted me. So keep your eyes open for that. I'll let folks know what's going on with that scene as well. But it'll be obviously more MMA grappling and kind of performance athletics oriented stuff I'll be writing for them. So
cool.
Yeah.
And Paleo Seminar this weekend?
Paleo Seminar this weekend in Oakland, which that'll probably, you know, this thing will probably post after that, but we just wrapped up in Potomac CrossFit, which was awesome. They took me out to an amazing restaurant, and we had gluten-free beer at that joint, and really, really good time. And then looming forward, we have Atlanta, and then we're looking at potentially Omaha, and... Man, I'm trying to think of where else we're looking, but definitely Atlanta, and then we're possibly looking at like New York City, New Jersey, something like that. All of that stuff kind of coordinated around the book release.
Nice.
Actually, immediately prior to the book release, but potentially. So yeah.
Rob Wolf will travel.
Indeed, I will. If you will have me, I will come sleep on your couch. So. And eat your bacon.
Exactly, as long as it's quality bacon.
Yeah, I'm pretty bacon agnostic. I'll eat just about any bacon. So, yeah.
Whatever, I'll eat anything. It's fine.
I've eaten a lot of like Residence Inn really shitey bacon. Although, yeah, that's about as low down the totem pole as I'll go. You know what's funny? Just as a story of bacon, the hooligans.
Oh my Lord.
Just as an aside, Andy's like, it's totally gone sideways, but. The kids at Potomac CrossFit, Brian Wilson and all of his folks are really, really cool, super funny. and they had some sort of a bacon eating contest. And one of his trainers, he told her, "Hey, you need to go get some bacon." And she busted out of the gym, started driving, and saw a convenience store, like a 7-Eleven, and went in and bought bacon there, which it's like a gas station convenience store that had bacon. Anyway, the long and short of it is normally Brian can really pound down some bacon, and he had to tap out on this event because the bacon quality was so horrible.
Wow.
I've never been aware that bacon was really an option at like a 7-Eleven kind of scene. So apparently there is even worse bacon than what you can get at a Residence Inn. So
that is kind of scary, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Don't buy bacon there.
Andy's totally unimpressed with that story. It gets edited out.
No, because I'll probably screw it up like the last one. Then I'll get complaints from listeners about what. Why did the episode drop at 27 minutes? I don't know. I thought it was fine. I listened to it.
It's Kelly Starrett-esque performance art.
That's right. That's right. Real and uncut. All right, Rob, are you ready for questions?
I'm ready to roll, man. Let's do this.
Nice.
Let's all cook right. While the skillet's hot.
In case anyone wonders, we're also testing some new Rob Wolf catchphrases. So, you know, put your votes in at any time.
We need to put the holy cats to rest for a little while. I still really like that one, so...
Oh, Rob.
Here we go.
20 years, someone will hear you speak and be like, man, this guy's really smooth. And I'll be like, man, I've been listening to him practice those same sayings for 20 years. We need new material.
Yeah, I think I've ran out of material between the seminar and the book. It's all done, so.
I'm sure you'll be inspired again. It'll come back.
Hopefully.
All right. First question from Annette. She says, okay, listen to your podcast steadily, love them, I know, whole food, on board with it. But as you well know, like with chia seeds, acai berries, goji berries, and a plethora of other superfoods, yes, caps and exclamation apropos, there's always something. Right now I'm looking at maca. Background, they gave up coffee about a week ago. I hated my life. I didn't get the headaches, but did get the other pleasure of a deep weariness setting deep in my bones and feeling as powerful as a kitten on Tylenol PM. And so, though my trainer only challenged me for a week, it was so rough the first few days, and now it doesn't suck as much. I thought, let's keep on trucking. And though one day I hope to welcome the bliss of the double shot Americano down from a quad with splash of heavy whipping cream back into my arms, currently I'm running an experiment on myself to see how long I can go. Which brings up maca. I don't want to F it up by giving my body a replacement, but I do like the idea of other fun drinks to have. So I have a jar of roasted powdered maca. Is this going to derail my mission, or is this an acceptable warm drink to embrace? Waiting on the literal edge of my seat for a response, it is precarious out here. And seriously, thank you for all your work. You and Andy have changed my life.
There are some amazingly talented people that comment sometimes.
It's I know. I was amazing. Like, this is a very well-written question.
Yeah, it really is. There's some funny stuff. You know, it's kind of funny. Like, just last night on my Facebook, I syndicated or, you know, shot around a link from Krista Scott Dixon of Stumptuous. She had a post which was F supplements. You know, just basically this blanket deal, like supplements are kind of ridiculous, focus on real food. And like in general, like I really buy into that, you know, especially up the list here, like all the kind of funky superfood deal. But I've also always said, I've always had the caveat that there are some cool herbals out there. There's some different things, you know, like alpha lipoic acid plus acetyl L-carnitine, I think is pretty kick ass for like waking you up in the morning and everything and has some other cool effects. Maca and some other adaptogens are pretty cool. I've used the same type of stuff, you know, like the roasted granulated maca. I ordered some from a particular company. I'll remember what it is and then we'll get it in the show notes. Maca is kind of cool. It's a kind of broad acting adaptogen. It helps both males and females with kind of normalizing hormone levels. I've been using this stuff off and on, kind of like a 3 or 4 days on, 2 to 4 days off, or I'll use it for like 10 or 12 days and then not use it while I'm traveling. And I like the effects. Like I definitely feel like I recover better from exercise. Seems like I'm a little more clear-headed and all that sort of stuff. So I kind of like the maca. And when you read up on it. There's some good stuff in the literature, and it's comparatively inexpensive. You buy a pretty good whack of the bulk stuff, and it's not really that pricey on like a per day basis. I don't know if I'd make it into a drink. Like, I actually just shoot a teaspoon of it in my mouth and swizzle it down with water, but you could definitely play with it.
I was just going to ask what it tastes like. What is the other thing that you had played with before as a warm drink in the morning? Was that mock?
It's called Raja's Cup, and it's from these crazy people from Maharishi International, and they're crazy. Like they're all into like the Maharishi Ayurveda stuff, and some of the Ayurveda stuff I really dig. And again, you know, they have some good stuff, and then they have some really, really wacky stuff. But the Raja's Cup had licorice, clearing nut, and one other item out of Ayurvedic medicine. But basically, all of them are really potent antioxidants. All of them have some adaptogenic effects. The licorice in the AM is particularly good for people if they have a little bit of kind of a tired and wired adrenal profile, in which you're feeling lethargic and kind of, you know, just bombed out in the morning, because the licorice actually blocks degradation of cortisol. And so if you're a little bit low on cortisol in the morning, it will actually help you to maintain some cortisol production in the AM, which people find is beneficial. Licorice can elevate blood pressure a little bit. It modifies some action on aldosterone, so you need to keep an eye on that, and maybe you don't use it every single day. But it tastes really, really good, and it has that really kind of potent chocolatey bitterness that you would get out of like a good espresso. So it's pretty cool stuff. It's a little pricey. You used to be able to find it in like Whole Foods and hippie health food stores and stuff like that, and you can only order it online at this point. But it's pretty cool. It has some good stuff.
Yeah, clearing nut, Kazmarg, licorice, and winter cherry.
Yeah, yeah. And if you dig up all of those items, there's some pretty good research on all of them. They're antioxidants, and they have some different kind of like anti-tumor, anti-necrotic effects, anti-angiogenic, you know, the growth of new blood vessels and everything. I suspect there's probably some COX-1, COX-2 inhibition going on with those items. So it's cool. You know, you could definitely give it a shot. I think a can of it is like $12, but then they claim it makes about 100 cups of you know, Raja's Cup out of it. So you can see how it goes. And maybe a local Whole Foods or hippie health food store may be able to order it for you, and then it'll save you the shipping. So,
yeah, this is interesting. Yeah, this 8 ounces, 85 to 95 cups, $12.95 on this website.
Yeah, so we'll do a link to the Raja's Cup too, and who knows, maybe we'll become a Raja's Cup distributorship.
Robin, I'm sad I can't drink it every day. I mean, you know what's going to happen here.
Well, just keep an eye on your blood pressure. Licorice in general can elevate blood pressure, so that would be a caveat for that, just for folks who are potentially borderline in that area to keep an eye on it.
Jeez Louise.
I know, it's so complex. Can't we just weigh and measure everything?
That's right. It'd be perfect. I'd be so happy. Ding dongs and a little bit of ribs. It'd be fine. All right, moving on. Question from our friend Squatchy. And he says, thanks, Rob. Here you go. Be the Sasquatch, Andy. Sasquatches unite.
Oh.
I'm honored to...
Princess Leia, quick.
I'm honored to have my question answered in the podcast. You guys rock. Thanks for the nickname compliments. I am male, by the way. A good friend of mine started calling me Squatchy back in high school. It caught on and stuck ever since. Speaking of all this talk of mass gain, so what is a healthy way to gain some good lean mass and put on some weight without feeling like crap and uncomfortably stuffing yourself all the time or screwing yourself up metabolically? What would you do if you wanted to gain some mass but not sacrifice health, well-being, feeling good in the process?
2 years of perspective on this now, almost 3, having gone through a lengthy mass gain and am finally leaning back down, but still have a little bit of what I would consider like insulin resistant kind of fat at the waistline that's been really hard to deal with, which I think is both insulin and cortisol. A long time ago, probably like 4 or 5 years ago, I was considering doing a mass gain because that's what I'm always considering doing because I'm just a skinny twerp and, you know, want to be bigger. And I was talking to Ido either via email or on the phone, and he said, you know, you need to get some stuff checked out. You know, basically kind of a biosignature kind of scenario. Go to a naturopath, go to a functional medicine doc, work with somebody who's got a biosignature background. But basically, from him looking at some photos that I had, he suspected that I probably had a little bit of cortisol stuff going on. And this was way early in the game, way before I've kind of blown myself up with, you know, crazy travel schedules and a bunch of other stuff. But he made the point that if your hormonal profile isn't good, your androgen levels aren't good, then doing a mass gain is just pretty much a waste of time. Like, you're not going to get the results that you'd like to get. You're going to get fat, and it's just kind of a really bad allocation of your resources. And naturally, I didn't do that. And went ahead and jumped in and did all this stuff and got very, very unhealthy in the process. And even when I went to the biosignature level 1 training and Pulikin ran all my numbers, he was basically like, dude, you know, have you ever met a donut or a carbohydrate that you didn't love, you know? And I'm like, you know, I'm eating cyclic low carb. I only do post-workout dairy, and other than that, it's like totally low carb. And he's like, well, then you obviously have like elevated cortisol and bad insulin sensitivity, and you need to lean down and get your house in order before you tackle this kind of mass gain attempt. And so this to me just sniffs a lot like the old recommendation that came out of the Berardi camp of, you know, like get lean before you do a mass gain. But I would add a further caveat to folks that unless you're kind of one of these naturally talented people who put on muscle pretty easily, like if you're a little bit challenged in that regard, like you like working out, but you've never been the dude or the chick, if there's chicks out there that want to do a mass gain, and God love you if you do, but if you've never been that person who really puts on muscle easily, I would really recommend at this point you go take some time and work with a functional medicine doc, a naturopath, somebody who, or anybody who has some background in checking normal androgen levels, sex hormone binding protein, growth hormone, cortisol, you know, like a 24-hour cortisol profile, testosterone, dihydrotestosterone ratios. Go do some investigating before you do all this, because it'll cost you a little bit of money to do this pre-screening. But when you think about how much money you spend on food, kind of the effort that's put into it, you would really like to have this stuff part, you know, all of that caloric intake partitioned into as much lean muscle mass as you can. And maybe this is getting overly grandmotherly on the whole thing, but at this point, I would really recommend kind of tackling it from that direction. Find a biosig practitioner, find somebody who knows some of this under the hood diagnostics. And I'm usually really reticent to recommend this, but do a little bit of self-analysis and try to figure out, you know, from what we've talked about, like, is your sleep really good? Is your recovery really good? All that sort of stuff. If it is, then jump in and go for it. And I think kind of a cyclic low carb, post-workout carb intake really be critical as to whether or not you want to use dairy, because I think dairy has some other collateral problems with it, but you know, it's definitely a potent growth promoter, so maybe you consider something like a quart to a half gallon of milk or goat's milk or something like that post-workout, and give yourself like a 3-month window and push it hard and then lean back out and then reassess whether or not you want to push it again. I would do it in a punctuated stair-step manner instead of just saying, well, I'm just going to be on this for like a year.
Maybe you should just redo yours, Rob.
No. Nikki would divorce me if I did another mass gain. The Gatto and I would be out on the street. So
no. Rob Wolf's new book cover will have him topless on it. So
I doubt it. I'm shy. I don't know. I doubt
it. You never know, Rob. You're lean now. You're lean.
I'm doing what I can, man. Trying. If I'm... if I can't be big, then at least I'll look like I know right. something about nutrition. So
rather than just sitting in the middle.
Yeah, instead of just like, so you don't really do much of anything, do you? It's like, oh man.
Now you look like just like a cross-country runner. It's fine. Don't worry.
A cross-country runner who does some pull-ups once in a while.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. All right, good, awesome. Good question, Squatchy. Next, we got a question from Paleo Pete. Freaking love the show. Another solid one, as always. In regards to mass gain and cortisol, do you have any advice for a skinny fat ectomorph? As this Mind and Muscle article goes over below, it seems that certain types of ectomorphs naturally produce more cortisol and therefore have a harder time gaining muscle and staying lean. Double whammy. I certainly have the body type described and also have naturally high stress levels. I went from 6'1", 170 and soft to where I am now, 193 with some fat all over. I seem to distribute it evenly and about the same amount of fat when I was at 170 on starting strength and 5x5 programs that have grounded to a halt on gains. I ate mostly red meat and veggies with fat coming from coconut milk, oil, grass-fed butter, and olive oil. Carbs are under 50 a day. Any overall advice for skinny fat would be greatly appreciated.
Man, this just dovetails right into the last topic. I think this person would likely benefit from some under-the-hood investigating if there's a legit issue with some consistently elevated cortisol. And we could probably dig that up in a variety of ways. One, an ASI test, checking the adrenal stress index, looking at some androgens like testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, see if we are getting any conversion of testosterone into the estrogen metabolites, check and make sure that progesterone is actually adequately high, because if cortisol is high, even in men, then the progesterone may be a little bit depressed because the main production is coming out of the adrenals as well, so that's another sign and symptom of elevated cortisol, is just depressed progesterone. But then another spot to look at is A1C. Like if we see some elevated A1C levels, then we know for sure that we have some chronically elevated cortisol, and elevated in a way that this guy is burning protein to convert it into glucose because of the stress and because of the cortisol. And if all of this stuff is happening, then any type of a mass gain or even just any type of attempt at being healthy and being lean are going to largely be thwarted here. It's just going to be much more difficult than somebody who has a more favorable androgen profile. So I would get in, again, check out some biosignature practitioners, try to find a functional medicine doc, naturopath who deals with this type of stuff, do some under-the-hood analysis, and then there are some really specific cortisol management protocols. There are some different herbal things that you can do to help prop up normal testosterone levels. Maybe for a period of time you might need to do some bioidentical progesterone to prop some of this stuff up. But that's where this stuff gets very, very specific. You can't really do a blanket statement on this stuff. You need somebody who knows what they're doing, and you can work with him or her to bring your operating parameters up. But just some little tweaks and nudges with this stuff could be really, really beneficial.
Yep. Sounds a lot like an assessment.
Sounds a hell of a lot like an assessment. And you're not going to do 20 people at once like that. So, yeah. Andy and I have had a would we call it a – it's not a neither war nor a battle for hearts and souls, just trying to figure out a good balance between how do you do fitness for the masses and how do you customize and individualize it for the people who need it, and how do you even know if they need more? And it's a really good question. Andy has been improving NorCal strength and conditioning with every day of his presence there. So.
Or irritating Rob.
Oh, irritating the piss out of me, but doing some really, really good stuff, and it's been fun. It's been fun.
I can never resist a chance for a jab. So there you go. That's my jab for the episode.
That one's just the reposte from my last one that was talking about, do you attend a seminar or panic if you don't know what to do next? So
yeah, we'll note that Rob is making jokes at my expense in like NorCal philosophical documents he's creating. Which may or may not be worse than calling him out on a podcast. I don't know.
I think it's better.
Anyway, moving on. Next, we got a question from L. Smith. Hi, Rob. Love your site. Listen to your podcast for the past couple months. I really appreciate the time you guys take to put this together. I have a question about the paleo diet and estradiol. I'm on TRT, and recent blood levels showed median total testosterone levels lowish, but in range free testosterone levels and slightly higher estradiol levels than I would hope for. Sex hormone binding globulin was slightly high, but still in range. I understand that sex hormone binding globulin, I mean, why? Can we make questions less complicated for Andy? No, just kidding. It's driven down by insulin and elevated by training. Is it possible that not spiking insulin enough could result in high SHBG, leading to elevated estradiol relative to testosterone? Background to put this in context, I am quite lean, always less than a legit 12, and I've always been this lean. I do workouts with an emphasis on anaerobic stuff, sprints, weightlifting, powerlifting, and lately tons of work on rings. Careful to avoid main page style wads because they tend to negatively impact my development of strength and power. That's a shocker. Diet is roughly paleo. Main deviations are peanut butter and the fact that my meat, eggs, etc. are not grass-fed. About a year ago, blood work showed similar total T numbers but lower estradiol levels and somewhat higher free testosterone. At that time, I ate a similar diet but included more carbohydrate. I definitely feel less zonked out with more veggies and less fruit in my diet, but I wonder if some insulin spike is necessary from a hormonal perspective to keep SHBG low. Could there be some truth to this, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
I think this is a great observation and one of those points at which taking advantage of some post-workout carbohydrate can definitely be helpful, because a little bit of elevated insulin, I would need to look at the kinetics on near kind of deal. Like if I take in a little bit of carb, then we get a little bit of suppression of sex hormone binding protein, sex hormone binding globulin, or if we have kind of a threshold with this. But there's no doubt that elevated insulin levels definitely suppress sex hormone binding protein. And when you suppress the SHBG, then you do have more free testosterone in general. But that wouldn't really address why Smith's getting some elevated estrogen. And that's going to deal with the aromatase enzyme. And so something has changed in his situation in which he's got some problems there. There are some things like crisin and some other kind of nutraceutical extracts that you can use to help block that conversion. But I think that this is a good thought to maybe consider using like yam, sweet potato. I think you would get less of kind of a wonked out effect if you're doing starchier type carbs for your post-workout scenario versus like fruit, because again, you know, the effect of fructose on the liver and how that can affect downstream signaling of like leptin and neuropeptide PYY and cholecystokinin and all that sort of stuff that deals with satiety. I think it also has a little bit to do with that brain fog. So I would just steer more towards like the yam, sweet potato, turnip kind of post-workout gig. And then might do some consideration of tinkering with some aromatase inhibitors to see if that changes your numbers with regards to the conversion of testosterone into the estrogen derivatives.
Cool. Good
yeah.
question.
Yeah, really good question. And definitely some good thought process going on there.
Next, we got a question from Multi Bomber. I don't know what that handle means, so maybe someone can help me. Hey, Rob, thought this might be a good podcast question. I live in Pacific Beach, San Diego, and we have a lot of vegetarian, vegan, dirty hippies all over the place.
I thought that they were all in Chico.
The weather's probably better in Pacific Beach, I think.
Way better, yeah.
I also work for an organic catering company, and I have to deal with said dirty hippie vegans all the time. While their complete lack of muscle mass, healthy hair, and use of soap is obvious, I continually find myself defending my stance of eating as much dead animal matter as possible. In a CrossFit video with Kelly Starrett, who Wellborn claims can heal the sick with his tears. You know, I thought that was Chuck Norris, but anyway.
It's Kelly Starrett now, and also he's known for some laying on of hands also.
Check. Yeah. Kelly points out that dense protein sources, i.e. anything with a face and soul that was unrepentantly slaughtered and put on a plate, are critical for glucagon production. I understand
glycogenolysis and the resulting gluconeogenesis, yeah.
No, man, it's really... Well, yet I'm unable to explain why it is so important to consume dense protein sources. Please tell me what to say to these dirty hippies to help them understand why quinoa and black beans just don't give the body the amount of protein it needs. Is the body unable to use the protein in these sources? What are they missing out on by not having adequate glucagon secretion? Is there no glucagon secretion whatsoever without dense protein sources? We'll go there.
Yeah, and the answer to that is basically, yeah, there's not glucagon secretion without dense protein sources unless you have hunger. Hunger will stimulate some glucagon release, but that's not, you know, from like a, we could look at that from like an intermittent fasting perspective, and that's definitely something that we want to massage once in a while. And I think it is totally normal, totally woven into our DNA to have some periods of fasting. Like I think there's no doubt that some of that is beneficial, and like we don't have to go overboard with it. Martin Burkham, you know, lean gains, I've written on this stuff, 16-18 hours here and there. I think that presses a nice reset switch. But I think also kind of woven into us, there's a tendency towards this more glucagon dominant hormonal profile, and there's a lot of cool stuff that goes on when we eat dense protein sources. I just mentioned a moment ago, like neuropeptide, PYY, adiponopectin, cholecystokinin. All of these hormones play a ton of different roles in the body, but some of the fundamental roles that they play are just in energy regulation, like the recognition that we have adequate food in our system, that our fuel tank is topped off, and protein-rich sources of food, meat, veggies, fish, meat, seafood, you know, eggs, that sort of stuff, they release these hormones in addition to glucagon. And so you do see like that kind of scrawny vegetarian who does beans and rice, but they're able to kind of pull this off throughout life and not really gain some weight. But it's kind of rare. Like I tend to see people, they hit a certain inflection point and then they start gaining weight. It's very kind of insulin related weight. It's very, you know, it's right around the midsection, all that sort of jive. It seems like if people stay generally away from gluten containing sources of vegetarian foods, then they tend to do better, which not a big surprise with that, as we know for sure that gluten is very, very potent with regards to damaging insulin receptor sites. But, you know, the long and short of this is that we're just wired up for a little bit more of a glucagon-dominant profile from our food intake. And that's piece number one. And then piece number two is I just wouldn't argue with these people at all. I know it gets hard, you know, just simply sitting down and eating your lunch at work, you know, it becomes kind of a scrutinized affair, but that's kind of the why behind it. And then I don't know that I would really argue with these guys at all, but if you're a little more fired up about it than I am, then by all means, go for it. But I don't think you're going to get any type of conversion out of this, so...
Yep, and Multi Bomber then goes on to ask, also ask, because I have a chef friend who is writing a cookbook for a woman he knows who has lymphoma. He's read many places that when you have cancer, you shouldn't consume any animal products. Any help you can give me in fighting the good fight against granola, hemp necklaces, and body odor would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every day we see this stuff where, like, meat causes cancer, meat shouldn't be consumed during cancer and all the rest of it. And then the interesting thing is that the only legitimate scientific like research data that we get related to different types of cancer, and lymphoma, I wouldn't really put in this category because it's a different flavor. But, you know, what do we see again and again and again? Ketogenic diets being beneficial for various types of cancer. And we're not seeing any type of like a vegan approach. Low protein, you know, actually I need to remove that, not low protein. There are situations in which low protein is beneficial for cancer scenarios, but this is under a ketogenic profile. And whenever somebody adopts a ketogenic diet, it is by nature a moderate to low protein intake, because if we take in too much protein, then we can convert protein into glucose. And you know, that's a problem for the ketogenic part. But then what we're finding, and Matt Lalonde and I were talking about this stuff, is that many types of cancer become very, very crafty about how they make glucose. And they will actually, these cancers will start converting sparing amounts of protein into glucose. And so that's where, if you were to adopt any type of a anti-cancer diet, it would be a low protein, high fat, very, very low carb approach, so that you're providing virtually no substrate for the cancer at all. But it's just ridiculous, you know. But the folks are going to believe what they want to believe, and obviously there's a horrible situation, and you want to do anything you can to help somebody with lymphoma. But non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the cause of that is gluten. So, you know, one of the primary causes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is gluten. So these folks are definitely barking up the wrong damn tree, which is unfortunate, but it's free world. You can figure out what you want to think and cherry pick what type of data you want to read, and that's what you run with. So, yeah.
All right. Good question. Enjoy the weather.
Yes, but not the hippies.
Next, we got a question from Jeff. Hey, Rob. I like this question. This is a good classic. Mike Metzer did a ton of work with high-intensity training, one set to failure, and consistently set new PRs throughout his bodybuilding career, even after achieving a perfect score in Mr. Olympia. Clearly not a novice. He had to continually invent new techniques to achieve these gains, but the focus was on a decrease in volume, increase in intensity, and increase in rest period rather than an increase in variability in activity. Can you comment on how you feel about Metzer's and Arthur Jones' research, as well as what you would recommend for someone who is interested in muscle size purely for look and not concerned with performance fitness? Also, Tim Ferriss used similar methodology to go from 146 to 187 in 28 days in a well-documented study at San Jose State University. For someone who has been chronically underweight his entire life, is this a good protocol to follow for expedited weight gain?
Man, this is a good one. There's a lot of moving parts to this. I'm actually going to retro-engineer this and talk about the Timothy Ferris piece first. One, Tim's not a big dude, but he normally walks around about a buck 65. So part of what went on with this is he actually got quite a bit skinnier than what he would normally run at before he did this mass gain. And then he went bananas on it, you know, did kind of a high-intensity weight training a la Arthur Jones, Mike Menzer, but a significant chunk of the weight that he gained was just kind of weight that was needing to go back on anyway. So there's a little bit of smoke and mirrors with that, but it also, he did make a pretty impressive push up to the 187, but he ate like crazy. And then, you know, now he walks around again at about a buck 65 because that's where his body naturally kind of gravitates to. And so there's that question of, like, what can you push your body up to, but then also what are you going to be able to maintain for the long haul? So that's just some stuff to keep in mind with regards to all the background on this. You know, there's no doubt that there – and I was just thinking about this the other day. I was reading some of Art Devaney's old work and talking about intensity being the key piece of muscle gain, you know, kind of momentary muscle failure. And there's no doubt that that's an element of this to some degree. You expose your system, expose the muscles to a loading that is greater than what they had previously. Then theoretically you cause a stimulus of growth and adaptation. But there's also no doubt that there's an interplay of volume in this stuff. Like, there are people that gain some significant body weight on an intensity biased approach, but then there's also no doubt that a volume-based approach works as well, you know, where people start looking at like 100 plus total reps or even more than that on a particular movement or muscle group. So it's not a one-way street with this, and I think usually for most people in a bodybuilding type scenario, you see a back and forth approach to this where they will play with an intensity phase that looks somewhat like a HIIT-esque high intensity training, you know, kind of one set to failure kind of deal, played back and forth with some volume work. And I think that that's a really smart way to tinker with all this stuff. I think you also see people who you know, Mike Mentzer didn't live all that long. And we now understand that there was a ton of drug use involved with this. I would argue that probably the steroids were a low on the list of causative factor of an early demise for him. But, you know, you've got to keep in mind some of the pharmacological effects here. You know, I mean, you just can't dismiss that stuff. So maybe he had a physiology that kind of gravitated more towards a hit type scenario. But then, you know, like is pointed out here, he had to really think a ton about the new techniques and the new approaches that he was going to do to stay within his hit parameters to keep making progress, and props to him for doing that. But could he have made similar or even better progress by simply alternating something that looked shockingly like periodization that played back and forth between volume and then intensity and then power? And would he have received, you know, similar or superior results? And this starts sniffing a whole lot like kind of a conjugate West Side method. So I don't know. I mean, there's some really cool stuff here. The thing that I like about this, and the thing that I really like about like Art Devaney's early stuff when he talked about doing sprints and alactic deadlifts and all that sort of jive, when you look at a lot of the work that Clarence Bass does, it's super economical. Like, it's a minimum stimulus for what would be kind of what I would think folks would generally consider to be kind of a maximum return on investment. And I have to say, you know, looking back at like kind of training journals and all that sort of stuff, like when I was really kind of following Art Devaney's old stuff of like a couple of days of sprinting, some alactic deadlifts, some hierarchical type sets where you start with an empty bar and move it slowly and create some lactate and, you know, add some weight and, you know, kind of run that pony to its end point. It was a really minimal amount of work with some pretty damn good results. When I started doing some CrossFit, I think that plugged some gaps in my game on a volume and intensity side. But I would have been smart to have broken that stuff into a 1 month, 2 month blocks and alternated back and forth between what would look like kind of an evolutionary fitness approach and what would be kind of a power bias, max effort, black box biased CrossFit approach. A little more volume, a little more, don't even know if I would say more intensity, a little more volume, but then curtailed volume, more intensity, a la kind of evolutionary fitness. And I think that would be a really cool alternating scenario with that.
Yep. Mike Mentzer is a beast.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. And then his brother, was it Matt? Mike and Matt? Either way, his brother was a phenomenal bodybuilder, too. I mean, just absolutely amazing. So, yeah.
And Tim Ferriss, man, that guy's a marketing genius.
He is, totally. He's phenomenal at that stuff. So, yeah.
All right, moving on. Good question. Mm-hmm. We've got a follow-up from Wayne. Great episode, especially since we answered his question. Got another one. As being in the male age group where the benefits of testosterone starts to decline, what ways can one help maintain healthy testosterone levels? I know diet, looking at pictures of naked women can help, but what other ways? Any food or supplements good for helping maintain or boost levels? Thanks. P.S. If you do start to approach double digits in listeners, you can start counting in hexadecimal. That should get you another year of single-digit listeners. Perfect. Thanks, Wayne.
For the new website, our tagline is going to be, for the podcast, 6 listeners can't be wrong, .. So that's what we're going to run with, Andy Deeds, and you're going to like it, baby.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord.
You know, this testosterone augmentation, supporting testosterone levels as dudes age, it's definitely an interesting topic. We've talked about it a little bit. The tribulus and, like, the nettle extracts and stuff like that, it's hard to get good data that shows that they actually do bump up testosterone levels. It seems like they have some nice effect on luteinizing hormone and some precursors for testosterone increase. But then as to whether or not they actually bump it up, it's kind of murky and the science is not real good there, just in that, you know, is it actually doing anything? But I have to say, like, when I've messed around with some better tribulus products, messed around with some tribulus nettles combos and whatnot, I definitely feel better. Like I you know, psychologically I feel better. Libido seems to be better. I'm 38, so I'm a little bit behind Wayne, who's 45. But I definitely seem to feel better. I've talked to James Fitzgerald about this stuff, and he's of the opinion that these good quality products can, will, and do work. So I think that's something to play with. And, you know, maybe at some point down the road, you start looking at some of the bioidentical hormone replacement or something like that. Michael Rutherford wrote a really good article for the Performance Menu a number of years ago about kind of balancing the cost-benefit analysis of that whole story, because when you start using bioidentical hormones, you're probably going to be kind of on that pony for the duration after that. And I think it's smart to get as much juice and mileage out of your own work, you know, your own body, before you start doing aftermarket modifications. So I think there are some products out there that could be tinkered with. Nettles extract, tribulus extracts and whatnot, and just play around with it. I mean, they're not really that expensive. There's not really any type of significant downside to them. And here I am usually saying not a huge supplement fan, but I have noticed some benefit to this stuff. Like, I just generally feel better. I can't say that, like, I, you know, I'm destroying workouts or anything hyperbolic like that. You know, it's just I just tend to feel a little bit better. So
yep.
I think it's worth tinkering with.
Damn you, Wayne. All right, question from Aaron. I think this is we've hit this kind of before from a slightly different angle, so we'll hit it again. Rob and cool. Andy, love the podcast and blog. You guys are awesome. I look forward to the podcast every week. Thanks for putting all this information out on the internet. Question about IF and calorie restriction. Is there a problem with doing IF alongside a period of severe calorie restriction? I've been playing around with IF for about 2 months now. Per your recommendations, I'm eating strict gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet and supplementing with natural calm and fish oil, training 3 times a week, linear progression strength, some high-intensity interval training, and scaled CrossFit WODs 1 to 2 times a week, and some LSD on the weekends.
Life Wait, we is, did do this question, didn't we?
This is similar. It's not the exact same question.
Seems I'm having like a fight club you know, Tyler Durden moment here where I'm like, what's going on?
It will all happen again.
Yeah. Okay.
Or did we do this question? Oh, my Lord, Rob, you may be right. Anyway.
You've done this one. Oh, well, we're doing it again, folks. So good at coming back for another
one. Uh-oh, I'm fired right now.
Performance art.
Life is stress-free for me. Graduated in May. Don't start work until July. Sleep is 9 to 10 hours a night. Going on from unweight, unmeasured paleo approach, less than 15 calories per pound of body weight, to a zone with deleted carb blocks, a la 42 ways to skin the zone. Want to make leaning out a priority. Should I drop the IF 16-hour fast per recommendations when doing zone? Everything I read highlights IF as an alternative to caloric restriction, so not sure if doing them together is a problem. Loved IF when I was unweighed and unmeasured, needing closer to 15 calories per pound of body weight. Not sure if I can keep it in the mix. Rob, you answer that, and I'm going to find the real question because now I know what happened. Ha!
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, we did touch on this one like a couple of podcasts back, and I think my thought at that point, and hopefully it's still the same answer.
That's why I'm
just making stuff up. Is that you know, when you're wanting to lean out, some caloric restriction is good, some insulin sensitizing is good, a la intermittent fasting. But then we know for a fact that if you subject yourself to too much stress, we're going to ratchet cortisol up. So I absolutely would not do severe caloric restriction and intermittent fasting at the same time. I think that would be a really, really bad idea. And I don't know if Andy's going to run away for an extended period of time.
No, we're close. We're close. Keep talking.
I don't know if I've got any more to say about that.
Well, just maybe you could just talk about the meaning of life.
Well, there's coffee and then there's bacon, so that pretty well brackets bookends the meaning of life. So
here we go.
Okay,
now we're ready. Okay, sorry, Aaron. She has a very nice picture on her avatar as well. So here we go, Rob. This is the original question that I screwed up. Now that I remember.
Okay.
And she's a figure competitor, so focus.
Wait, which photo was this?
Erin Elberson. It's her like little avatar on the blog.
Oh, I remember her. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she has like reddish hair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Rob's like, I remember, of course.
Yeah.
Hi there, and thanks for all the great info you're sharing. I've just recently found the podcast and I'm catching up. I'm a science geek too, so really appreciate the geeks out bits. I have celiac. My diet is not paleo. I still consume dairy and brown rice. I'm an amateur figure competitor and preparing for a show in September. So don't want to make wholesale changes in the diet right now. The plan is for paleo after the show. My prep is very sane for a figure gal. 3 to 4 days a week resistance work and 2 to 3 days high intensity interval training, and then just some low-level activity with walking. Tracking and weighing at 5'7 and currently 125, losing fat at about 1,700 calories with protein of about 125 to 145 grams. Carbs and fat variable dependent on training or cardio off day. After my show, I'd like to transition to a non-measuring, non-weighing paleo diet to maintain 5 to 7 pounds over stage weight. Would this be a really bad idea after a contest diet since my appetite regulation may be impaired a bit? Even though I'm dieting smartly, it's still caloric restriction, and I imagine there may be a small amount of hyperphagia rebound going on. I can control it if needed, but it sure would be nice to be able to rely on hunger cues instead of a scale. I definitely don't want to go nuts with eating, but would love to be able to relax a bit about food. I feel very fortunate that I have only a minimally unhealthy psychological relationship with food after competing in figure on and off for a few years now. Any tips on easing the transition into a non-measuring paleo plan? Secondly, tips on buy-in to help me with my husband. He's a genetically gifted individual who's been able to eat McDonald's and pizza and keep good body composition externally now. He's 42 and just beginning to notice a small metabolic slowdown, so now Taco Bell is less frequent. He does train. He won't go get blood work done. I cook quite a bit at home, which helps, but he still goes for cereal, bread, and fast food when I'm not around. He's not the most open-minded about his food choices. For his health and my peace of mind, I would love it if he would make the change over to at least more paleo-esque. I'm thinking my best bet may be to cook some phenomenally tasty paleo meals. Any tips for dealing with that? Thanks so much. Looking forward to the book.
Her husband sounds like one of our standout athletes in our gym that we've had a tough time to get compliance with on the food, which is kind of funny. But, you know, John Wellborn worked with a couple of figure competitors. I've worked with a couple of figure competitors for off season, you know, just walking around leaner than what you're used to walking around. The kind of unweighed, unmeasured paleo is awesome. Like, you definitely will find that is easier than what you've historically been doing. You just kind of have to keep an eye on where your carbohydrate tolerance is and go more like yam and sweet potato, fruit, kind of moderate because of the kind of fat promoting effects that we get out of that. And this is just, you know, if body composition is really the premium that you're looking for, which obviously in figure it is, then it's just kind of a shift that's going to be easier for you. All the way around, like when she's mentioning potential like rebound hyperphagia and stuff like that, like overeating after this caloric restriction, the really low body fat, what's a great way of mitigating that, which is basically send satiety signals to the brain. And one of the best ways that we can do that is a higher protein, higher fat intake. And so you keep a little eye on portion sizes, but if you're releasing, again, cholecystokinin, neuropeptide YY, PYY, adiponopectin, which all these things are released primarily from protein intake, secondarily from fat intake, tertiary carbohydrate releases far, far less of these satiety hormones, to say nothing of leptin. All these things are released far less from carbohydrate than they are from protein and fat. So you do a more protein and fat oriented approach. Sounds like her diet is generally pretty good because she's celiac, so like she's doing some brown rice, but I still see people have less appetite control with brown rice and corn than they do from like yams and sweet potatoes. And I think that's just still the lectin content of those foods. And she's obviously very, you know, dialed into what works for her body. So she should notice some benefit to this. If it's really going to work for her, she should notice some benefit immediately. But the feedback that we get from folks is that the basic kind of paleo shtick, particularly on the higher protein, higher fat side, works amazingly. And like, we end up doing very, very little cardio type stuff with the fitness folks that we work with. It's much more of like some interval weight training and then standard like heavy weight lifting and stuff like that. And they do really, really well. And then when we're trying to lean folks out, then we are doing some weighing and measuring for fitness competitor scenarios, because we are introducing a level of caloric restriction that it's tough to pull off without some guidelines to follow. But usually folks are walking around leaner than what they would normally be. And so they have an easier jumping off point. As far as getting the hubby on board, I don't know. I mean, this is the challenge of the genetically gifted. They've been able to skate by on genetics. They don't have to work as hard as other people, and they're just effing lazy, you know. And it's annoying. You could make a little push for the health thing. If he's noticing some slowdown, there is no, you know, kind of metabolic slowdown. Maybe not as lean, not as good a recovery as what he's had before. There was absolutely no doubt that he would look, feel, and perform better by tweaking his food. But whether or not he's motivated enough to do that, who knows? But this is definitely the challenge of being a little bit genetically talented. You just get lazy.
Yes. So sad. So sad.
Which Andy and I definitely suffer from that. So.
Yes, that's why I hardly go to the gym.
I look, anyway, good. What's Ito's line? I look at a weight and gain muscle. Or no, that's Art Devaney's deal. But
no, but Ito had something on Facebook the other day. He was talking about his training, and someone asked him about it. And he was like, "I have to stay below 2.5 times body weight back squat, and be careful with my training, or I go above that." And I think the average person's reading that and like being like, "What?
Yeah, yeah.
You have to try to stay below that. Like, how does that work?"
When Ito was in the Israeli military for, I think they have like a compulsory service and all that sort of stuff, just farting around training, he had over 45 dead hang pull-ups. These are non-kip pull-ups and like full open shoulder, like clavicle touch, like 40 pull-ups and no periodization, just like sick volume, and he had 40 dead hang pull-ups. So he's a bastard.
We're very jealous of Ito's physical capacity. Anyway.
Yeah.
Moving on. Next, we got a comment from John. I've been a podcast lurker for the last 7 months, listened to several episodes at once, and then wait a few weeks, then repeat. You are a glutton for punishment, John. I really appreciate what you guys provide. While I'm still in the linear gains level, I'm an avid swimmer and currently following CrossFit football. I'm sure I get less than adequate sleep and eat less than 100% pale every single day. However, I have more days where I feel great and perform well. I'm not as lean as the guys who compete in the CrossFit games, but I don't know if I have ever had a six-pack. I've been silently lurking in hopes that someone would ask my question so that I wouldn't have to, but here goes. Number one. I've about had it with docs whose specialty ends in...
Ologist.
Jesus. I've been to 3 immunologists, a cardiologist, nephrologist, and scheduled to see a gastroenterologist. The original symptom for which no one can find a cause, my feet swell when I eat salt, and not just a little. My wife and I affectionately refer to them as the baked potatoes. When it gets to the point of discomfort, I recently found I could drink coconut water, and that relieves the pressure but does little to reverse the swelling. I want to know what I can do about it, other than reduce my salt intake and elevate my feet, because I'm already doing that to the best of my ability. Any thoughts on that, Rob?
Definitely something to do with, I mean, this sounds obvious, you know, salt metabolism. He's super sensitive to this. I would be interested to know if his blood pressure is going up when his feet swell. And if not, then there's if his feet swell but his blood pressure doesn't go up, then there's some sort of a venous return issue, I would be willing to guess. Like there may be some valve issues. There's something about, like, he's basically getting some pooling of fluid in the lower extremity, which is largely to do with like the venous return. If he's not seeing some sort of a blood pressure increase, if he's seeing a blood pressure increase, then he's just wickedly sensitive to sodium across the board, and this is just kind of what it is. I think when he takes in the coconut water, then he's seeing a little mitigation in the problem, because he's taking in some magnesium and some potassium with that. But I'm somewhat sensitive to salt. Like I can notice my hands and feet swell, especially if I get some salty food and then I fly, I'm traveling, then I'll notice a little bit of feet swelling. So
yep.
Yeah.
All right. And part two, as a result of an ultrasound on my kidneys from the nephrologist, I know I have an enlarged spleen with granulomas.
Granulomas, yeah.
Yeah, granulomas. Is there anything dietarily that could cause this because I'm not sick? My white blood cell count at the time frame was fine. Could it be trauma? If so, how much? I got thrown a lot during a 2-month Marine Corps martial arts program.
You know, impact trauma can cause damage to any of the tissues, like the spleen. The spleen, though, is kind of our sieve or repository for immune cells. And if Mike Malloy ends up listening to this podcast, maybe he can chime in the comments. If you had some sort of a wacky illness that really caused some big white cell count proliferation, you can end up with some irritation in the spleen, and that it might be some after effect of that. But that's just stabbing in the dark. Like those are kind of, you know, you could have some impact trauma that could cause that. And there could be some after effect of having gone through a pretty severe illness at one point, and then caught, you know, it basically is going to cause some scar tissue, essentially.
Yep. All right. Good. Good question. Okay. So now we have a very long question from Mark. So I'm going to try to muddle my way through this, and then Rob is going to wow us with his answer.
I'll make it even more muddy and oblique. So,
Rob, great podcast as always. Really happy to hear you talk about what fitness is. I wanted to get your thoughts on something I've observed the last 4 seasons working as a backcountry ski guide out of a lodge where all the skiing is human powered. You hike and skin up, and then you ski down. Unlike the other guides who are in the mountains constantly, I sit at a desk for 10 months and a guide for 2, so I'm very aware of training and preparation. We ask our clients what they've done from a training standpoint to prepare, and generally our clients essentially fall into 3 fitness buckets: CrossFit folks, endurance or regular marathoners, and guys who just ski. Marathoners get hurt on day 4, so regularly that we take it very easy on day 4. The power requirements of going up 10 to 15,000 vertical a day with the pack, skis, and boots are just too much, so knees, hips, and backs just give in. Guys who ski tend to do okay, but generally aren't strong enough to keep up with the volume after a few days. CrossFit folks do great on day 1, but after 4 years and 50-plus CrossFit clients, generally level 3-ish, only 8 have made it out of bed and up the hill on day 2. So far, 5 women and 3 guys have managed. On day 2, CrossFit ladies only have about a 15% fail rate, which is the overall client average, while CrossFit men have an outstanding 90% plus fail rate. Our clients are mostly guys. On subsequent days, the guys do fine, but are way less ambitious. Ironically, given all the t-shirts, posters, and whiteboards out there, get up and do it again seems to be a big issue. When it comes to When it comes to mountain-specific training, guys like Twight and Shaw have pretty much cracked the problem with the same general techniques as CrossFit, but with longer efforts and more of a strength focus than typical CrossFit programming. Clearly, the activity I'm talking about here is a repeated power endurance event that also requires a lot of peak strength at specific times rather than a short work capacity type effort. However, when I look at life and the kinds of activities active adults do outside of a box, we are talking about a long weekend backpacking trip, a couple days mountain biking, a weekend rugby tournament where you end up playing 4 to 5 matches, etc. It seems to me that, with the exception of combatums and other very specific endeavors, life is a power endurance event. That said, the huge difference in male-female performance leads me to believe that there are psychological social factors at play. Is the ingrained idea conceit that I'm gonna swear unfuckwithable and ready for anything lead a lot of men to push much harder than they should, even though, or maybe because, the guides tell them to take it easy. Women don't seem to have anything to prove to a bunch of dudes and dial it down as needed. Is there something to the different psychological approach required for the different efforts? 15 minutes as many rounds as possible is going to hurt a lot, but it's done in 15 minutes. Climbing up a 2,500 foot slope 5 times a day is a grind, and you got to get your head in a place just to work through it. In the issue is the issue for the CrossFit that the longer grinds just don't fit the business model? If you've got clients physically working for an entire hour, not just in the box but actually working, does it mean you have to cut the number of clients you can get in and out? I'd like to get your thoughts on both the physical and psychological aspects. It seems to me
like both are gaping holes in the CrossFit definition of fitness. Needless to say, we're trying to manage the group dynamics so we don't have a bunch of very fit clients staring at bacon and eggs on their second day wondering what the hell happened. We've also tried to get clients on more of a mountain athlete plan for the months before they come out, but it's very hard for folks to find a space to follow that sort of programming. A lot of boxes just don't have the flexibility to let a client do their own thing. Thanks for your thoughts and sorry for the long blog post.
Man, amazing blog post. Like really, really interesting. We could do a podcast alone on this deal. You know, the psychological piece I think is definitely a factor. Like obviously the dudes tend to run a little more testosterone, and I think you get used to I think that he's just spot on here. You know, you get used to crushing stuff in 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 45 minutes. You know, in some affiliates, they may even push stuff out that long with a lot of these chippers and longer efforts. But it's a totally different animal than being able to get up day after day and have this kind of grinding workload. I think there's a piece of that. I also think so like that psychological piece, like if you're leaving just a little bit in the tank, then you're more likely to be able to get up and do it again versus like if you're just completely blowing yourself out each time, then you know, there's just nothing left to work with. That was our problem when we were dealing with Lou Mars when he was doing his marathon drum deal. He would drive himself to exhaustion again and again and again, and then when it came time in those final hours to need to dig down and have something there, there was nothing there because he had exhausted himself multiple times. There was no capacity left. And really, at some point, there's almost no amount of training that can prepare you for that when you're driving yourself to exhaustion repeatedly. Like, you've only got so much capacity in that. Like, you need to know when you need to push and when you need to reel back and leave a little bit in the tank. And if you're operating under these parameters from a point of ego, then it's going to be hard, you know, and yeah, you'd slowly learn what your capacity is and all that sort of jive. So I think the psychology is certainly a big factor. I know women also, to some degree, are a little bit better fat mobilizers and do a little bit better under some endurance situations than guys do, and so there might be a little bit to do with that. I mean, there's probably some of the psychology, some of the possibly a little bit of different physiology kind of combining there. And then this is just a great example of like specificity wins at some point. You know, if you build a nice good engine but at some point, you just need to be efficient on the skis. And that's where you see this stuff where, like, the marathoners have a big heart, big lungs, but no sport-specific strength. The CrossFitters have kind of a broad general inclusive capacity, but probably aren't nearly as good on the skis as the dudes that ski. And then the folks that ski have connective tissue integrity. They have efficiency in the movements so that they are not blowing themselves out and they're not subjecting themselves to bad movement patterns. Here's that 20% slop thing. I guarantee you the people who ski consistently do not have 20% slop, so they're not developing orthopedic problems. And to the degree that they do develop slop, they're getting injured, they're getting hurt. You know, it's kind of funny when you start playing around with this stuff and if the time indexing starts pushing out longer and longer, what you start seeing is a need for what I would call kind of a modicum of metabolic conditioning, like kind of classic CrossFit conditioning, probably more on the kind of aerobic interval stage versus anaerobic interval stage. And then dedicated strength training, mobility work, and then enough time left to tackle your specific sport. And early deal when Mark Twight wrote for the CrossFit Journal, and I think he still has this account on the Jim Jones site. I haven't checked it out in a long, long time, but you know, he mentions that he did pretty well, I think, at the Powder Keg ski race or whatever by just doing shorter efforts. But Mark was pretty good on the skis as it was. I mean, not a professional, but he certainly knows his way around a set of cross-country skis. And so he was able to maintain a fitness base pretty well that supported his already well-established technical base. But then in subsequent efforts, when he was doing some bike riding or some different stuff like that, that really pushed the time indexing out much, much further, the short training efforts just didn't cut it. Like, it completely blew up. And part of it is the psychological element of it. And there's also, you know, we understand more and more about, like, the central governor effect, which is the brain understanding or having some input about this, the substrate resources that we're using, how much protein, carbohydrate, and fat have we burned and used in the body in a particular effort. And if we haven't trained the body and literally the mind to be comfortable with digging into the stored resources in an aggressive manner, we'll get fatigued and we'll shut down. We'll have much more of a tendency to do that. And there's just no way to build that capacity without going out long. You just can't do it. Interval effort, strength, all that stuff's important, but at some point the specificity wins out. It just has to. It would be really nice. It would be nice if there was a cheap, easy route, like the route to the dark side without the work, but it just doesn't work. You've got to get that efficiency from somewhere, and that's just from doing it.
What do you think of his question about life being a power endurance event?
I think this is, it falls right. You know, life is far more of a power endurance event than it is a lactate meltdown. And I think that this is a lot of the failing. This is where I think when people first happen onto CrossFit, they see a really remarkable bump in their performance because they're really focusing on one specific metabolic pathway that most of us run from like the plague, you know. And initially you see some cool adaptations and some really nice benefit, but then the reality is that most of our efforts are both harder and briefer, or easier and longer for the most part. And he had the great observation here, the probably main exception to that is combatives. When you get into jiu-jitsu, you get into boxing, get into kickboxing, it's a time indexed affair, particularly if you're competing in this stuff. And it's time indexed typically somewhere in that like 3 to 5 minute range. Some grappling tournaments have like the, you know, like 15 minute rounds and stuff like that, and it's a different deal. But that's when we, you know, by and large, we're looking at more of a kind of lactate meltdown kind of gig. But when we're looking at rugby, at football, at hiking, military stuff, you know, whatever, Wellborn's gotten a ton of feedback from people doing CrossFit football, and they're doing work in Afghanistan, work in Iraq and stuff like that, you know, like search and arrest type stuff, you know, sprinting from one point of cover to another, breaching a door, arrest and control type things, that looks way more like a power endurance story than it does a lactate meltdown story. It just does. And it's not to say there's not lactate production. It's not to say that you don't dip into those areas occasionally, but it looks much, much more like a power endurance kind of gig. Hard, explosive effort followed by much more of a restive situation, and then maybe a lower intensity, longer pacing. It's interesting. Like I think those efforts in general produce kind of a better hormonal profile. Certainly, occasionally dipping into that full on lactate meltdown is great for fat loss and growth hormone production and all that. But you just can't maintain that stuff all the time. You can't do it.
Yep.
Really interesting question though. Like a really interesting observation out of all this.
Mark Twight. Jim Jones has 3 certification levels now, Rob. Get there.
I'll certify some folks and some food. I'll let them and OPT do the training certification and call it good with that. So
I'm just busting your chops. And with that, Rob, that's the end of the episode.
Sweet.
Hour and 14 minutes.
Ooh, that was a beefy one.
Yeah, well, you can tell we're tired because we're not aware that we went that long. I'm like, 45 minutes. We're fine.
It's okay. Well, and we had a bonus question that was repeat.
We'll see if you, you know, how off you were the second time you answered it.
Or like it was completely different than it was the first time. So,
are you just making this up?
Yes.
Well, Rob, with that, man, I'm gonna let you go so you can get on your way to Oakland.
Cool. Right on, Andy.
Thank you very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, man. Take care.
All right. See you, Rob.
Bye.